Voices of VR podcast.
Hello, my name is Ken Bai, and welcome to the Voices of VR podcast. It's a podcast that looks at the structures and forms of immersive storytelling and the future of spatial computing. You can support the podcast at patreon.com/voicesofvr. So, continuing my series of looking at AWE past and present, today's interview is with Suzanne Borders, conversation that I had with her at AWE in 2021. So, in the previous conversation, you get a little bit of like the very early beginnings of Bad VR. In fact, there's a lot of different connections that Suzanne talks about that happened there at the Magic Leap LeapCon back in 2018. And that was really a turning point for her in the journey of Bad VR. And so, 3 years later, I was able to catch up with Suzanne again just to get a sense of all the different things that they've been working on. So, at their booth, they had a number of different demos. They had lots of different platforms. They had Tilt 5. They had Quest and HoloLens and Magic. I mean, basically, it was like a bunch of different platforms that they were using. We talk around some of the ones that have continued to be developed and released, this application to use VR to visualize the strength of Wi-Fi and cellular signals. And yeah, just how they're taking this democratized approach to data visualization, trying to find ways to give access to people that they don't need to be data analysts, but they can start to get these intuitive senses of spatial architecture to data visualization within the context of XR. So we're covering all that and more on today's episode of the Voices of VR podcast. So this interview with Suzanne happened on Thursday, November 11th, 2021 at Augmented World Expo in Santa Clara, California. So with that, let's go ahead and dive right in.
Hi, I'm Suzanne Borders. I'm the CEO and co-founder of Bad VR. Broadly speaking, within the VR and AR realms, we use AR and VR technology to visualize complex data sets to make the discovery of insights in those data sets faster, easier, and more importantly, universally accessible to everybody. So that's our goal is really focused on, you know, right now, data is more valuable than gold. The people that are able to access that data and work with that data are a very, very small group of select individuals that tend to come from the same socioeconomic background, the same universities, the same sort of social groups. And my vision and overall mission for Bad VR is to use immersive technology to remove those sort of barriers to entry for normal individuals, normal, like non-highly trained technical data scientists, just an everyday person to be able to put on a headset and step into their data and see the sorts of things that they would otherwise have to, you know, hire a data analyst for or work with a complex data analytic team.
Great. So maybe you could give a bit more context as to your background and your journey into working with immersive technologies in this way.
Yeah. So I started off, I studied psychology in school. I thought that I was actually going to be probably a substance abuse or teenage substance abuse counselor. That's sort of what I wanted to be when I was of college age. But I ended up getting in my car. I went through a really traumatic experience where I lost my best friend to cancer. Well, let me back that up a little bit. I grew up in Kansas City. I went to school in Kansas City. I was living there right after I graduated from school, and my best friend, like I said, passed away from cancer. So I didn't want to stay there anymore. I was like, you know, I just kind of want to like start fresh someplace else. And at the time, I had been doing events promotions for like punk rock shows and music events, and I was learning how to like make websites. I didn't realize that that would be considered coding at the time. It was just sort of like, you know, I'd make MySpace pages or event pages, or I would build forums for like local bands and help build their fan bases. So I was really into like doing website stuff. And so when I got in my car and I just started driving west, I ended up out in California. And I thought, you know, I'd like to dive a little bit deeper into technology. I really like what technology is doing for the music space. I like the creativity around websites and web spaces at the time. This was like really basic HTML stuff, like pre any sort of like, honestly, like pre-Facebook, pre all of that, Snapchat, all of it. So at the time, I lived in Los Angeles. I was working as a bartender. I started going to local meetups. Like, I thought, okay, I'll teach myself to code because I knew a lot about HTML from working in MySpace. Tom taught us all basic HTML. And I thought, you know, maybe I'll be a coder. Maybe I'll be like a hacker person. I'm really interested in this. But I quickly learned that I didn't have the patience for that. However, I was really passionate about the way that humans interacted with technology. And I thought this is a really great way to use my studies in psychology and to not really throw that away, but to bring that to a new medium and to really sort of make that the focus of what I wanted to do. And I found out about the whole discipline of UX. Like, I didn't even know that was a thing until I was like, what, 20, moved to California in 2009. So I've been like 26 or 27. That was the first time I'd ever even heard the word. You know, it just didn't occur to me. And once I found that sort of discipline, I was like, this is absolutely for me. I really want to do this. And I'm a very competitive person, so I have to be the absolute best at this. So I found a couple mentors. I started really diving in. My very first jobs were like contract, you know, people would hire me, and I was doing just like really basic website design, nothing really complicated. My first full-time job, I got hired to help build a survey application, and my focus was designing this interface for all of the live data that was coming in from the survey. So the very first thing I really started to design were these data, like whether it be, you know, the way that's displayed on a mobile phone or whether that's displayed on a desktop or how it, you know, those experiences translate to different sizes of screens, building dashboards. And from there, I really just got into loving data visualization and presenting it and really focusing on designing things that are usable by everybody. Because all of the products that I've worked on, starting from that company, which is Oserve, and then going into a company they worked at called Remind that did data visualization and analytics for residential real estate, all of the end users were very non-technical. Whether you're talking about people coming into a Best Buy to take a survey, or you're talking about real estate agents, they're not your traditional like data science or data analytics people. So I really enjoyed that process of taking this really complicated data and just like distilling it down into these very usable interfaces and then saying, look, you have the power of all this data to either improve your business if you're a real estate agent or to make better decisions about product placement or in real life experiences if you're, you know, using the survey product. So along the way at these companies, I met my co-founder, Jad, who is usually the developer or the lead technical person. I was really impressed with his ability to code. He was also very supportive of usable interfaces, which I was really passionate about. And he was really passionate also about, you know, making things accessible to everyone and would really, from a developer's perspective, like try to bring that simplicity, that like usability to everything. So eventually moving through my career, you know, started from basic ground up UX designer, got into lead UX, director of UX, got into some product development. I was working back in late 2017 at a company called Crexy, again doing data visualization analytics for this time the commercial real estate industry. And I was just hitting every conceivable limitation offered by 2D screens. So like every project, more and more data was being integrated, and I was asked to be designing these interfaces that had to remain simple, but had to incorporate more and more and more data sets. So because I was working on geospatial or working with geospatial data sets, it made total sense to me to like look at it multidimensionally, because everything that I would basically have to compress it down anyways into a 2D screen when it was inherently 3D. And I just thought like it makes so much more sense to just present this information in three dimensions. And if I do that, I can present like many more data points at the same time. I wouldn't have to make these sort of payoff choices where do I show this or do I show that, because I can't overload the user with these data sets. So I had the idea to add in AR and VR technology. I did some sort of, you know, basic asking around, like, is this a viable idea? Looked into the market from the hardware side, because this, you know, being late 2017, the hardware still was not exactly mobile. It wasn't super user friendly. So I just sort of waited around. Eventually it came across the Mirage Solo, which was very portable, user friendly. And then shortly thereafter, it was the Oculus Quest, the Quest 1. So anyways, the whole thought being, okay, well, this hardware is getting...
So the Quest 1 or the DK1, just to make sure the timing?
Yeah, that would be... Let's see. The Oculus DK1 was the first VR headset experience I ever tried. But no, that was before. So this would have been the actual Quest 1.
Okay. Just to make sure.
Yeah. But shout out to the DK1, because that was the very first VR experience I had. It was the roller coaster app on that. It totally like blew my mind, because I could actually physically feel the embodiment of being on a roller coaster without having that actually occur to me. Anyway, so I contacted Jad, my former boss, and I was like, look, if I'm going to start this business, the only person I really want to do it with is you, because you have the same passion for solving problems in a very user-friendly way, the same passion for making technology available to everyone, and you have extensive experience doing data analysis, data visualization, extensive experience building, and things that you've been working on privately that you could bring to the table that would really help from a technological perspective. And I'm also not a technical founder, so I needed to have that expertise with me. I took him a while, but finally convinced him. So we started off Bad VR early in 2018. So that sort of brings us to where we are now. We've been in business ever since then. The date being, what is it? Fall of 2021. So it's been a while, but that's the background.
Okay, yeah, because I had a chance to talk to you at the Magic Leap LeapCon in 2018. I think it was probably you just had started up, and I have that conversation in the archive that I hope to get out eventually at some point, but I was able to actually try out a lot of different experiences here and just really impressed with the kind of range of different types of visualizations. I just did a talk for Frederick Helbergs and Laura Lesmus. They have a class at the University of Toronto. Architectural students were looking at data visualization and gathering with folks, and so I went back through a number of different conversations that I've had over the years and to kind of retrace what I was told and trying to find different things that were either supporting what I was told anecdotally. One thing that I remember, Oliver Kralos, who's known as Doc Ock, he did the VR UI system that he was posting demos of this back in like 2013, data visualizations where he would show the Earth with earthquake data that was in GPS, but also depth information that you could zoom in and actually see a lot of that. And one of the things he told me in either my first or second interview with him is that he said most of the 3D data visualization is connected to volumetric space, so things that are connected to objects. And he said that there's a whole other branch of more abstract data visualization, and that a lot of those folks have been more skeptical or cautious of that because of the issues of scaling and occlusion or different issues that if you're only looking at it in a 2D projection actually make it harder for you to really discern what was happening in the visualization, and that often a lot of those more abstract versions of data visualizations were leaning more towards the 2D versions rather than doing the immersive or 3D. So I noticed a lot of your visualizations do have like a volumetric element. And so I'm just curious to hear some of your thoughts on both how powerful it is to have a space and visualize data on that space, but also some of the frontiers and challenges of doing the more abstract data visualization and immersive visualizations.
Yeah, I mean, I think that when you're talking about for the right now moment, it's a very easy sell in terms of getting people to understand the value of looking at data multidimensionally with an AR and VR headset. If you talk about, you know, volumetric geospatially tied data sets like weather data sets, even like the experience that you tried with propagation of RF signals throughout a room, being able to look at how that data actually is tied to your real world environment. That sort of stuff people really understand, or, you know, geospatial data, building data, all of that. They just have an immediate visceral understanding of why that has value and why that would make sense to view it in a multidimensional format. When you start talking about the more abstract data sets that don't necessarily have a geospatial tie-in inherently, like they aren't tied to a specific place, whether it be your environment or a specific environment or a latitude, longitude, or a coordinate, I think the biggest problem that people run into is, well, how do you display that multidimensionally if not through a 3D scatter plot or a bar chart or line graph? It's really, you have to think about it. I think personally it's a design challenge. Just like, well, how do I show this? Like, what is the way that I would even interact with this? How would I even look at this? Some of the stuff, you know, it has, you could tie it into a geospatial format, or for instance, you could do, you know, like a building visualization, that things that would look like buildings that would really be tied to particular data sets, like a 3D, how do I say it, like a tree chart, but with a third dimension. But again, you're going back to that, like, okay, well, here's an established 2D analogous thing, and we're just going to add another dimension to it. And really, when you start talking about that, the value add of looking at that in three dimensions or four dimensions doesn't really add so much value, because looking at it on a 2D screen, 3D object on a 2D screen usually is enough for people. So you really have to like throw everything aside from like the standard ways that you've looked at data in two dimensions and really think, well, how would I, moving forward into the future, build these standards to look at these particular types of non-geospatial data sets in immersive spaces? And one of the ways that we've come up with at Bad VR is something we call a data stadium, where you're in the middle of what would be basically seeming like a stadium, but instead of people sitting in seats, you have each seat as an individual data point. So the real big value out of this is that you can see patterns across the whole, but you can drill down all the way to the individual data point. You can go into the section, you can go into the row, or you can go all the way down to the single data point without losing the greater context. Because that's the biggest problem with two-dimensional, is every layer that you dig into the data, you lose the greater context. You get more and more myopic the greater you drill down, closer you get to the individual data point. So that's a brand new way that doesn't really have a 2D analogous thing. It's not really a chart or a graph or a style of visualization that was ever utilized in 2D, mainly because it is fundamentally and inherently three-dimensional. So I think that's really where we're focused on, is like, what are the brand new ways that we can do this? Don't get me wrong, if we don't have all the answers, that's one of them. But that's also why we've started where we started, in terms of like finding solutions or use cases for data visualization that are immersive, that are tied to real world environments, just because it's a little bit of an easier start. But definitely we are continuing to do research into new ways of showing non-geospatial data, coming up with really different, unique, hopefully better ways, hopefully fundamental, you sort of building those blocks of like, what are the standard ways of doing this in immersive spaces? Like, what is the scatter plot? What is the bar chart? What is the pie chart for immersive technology? So,
yeah. And I think I was able to actually see the data stadium example in one of the demos that you have here, where you have inventory parts and you're able to choose different locations. And it's almost like you can turn them all off and see what parts are in different locations for all the different parts that create an engine, and then be able to see where the parts are relative. And it's kind of turning them on and off. And it's more of like a high level, like, oh, this place right here has most of the parts. And, you know, just see, you know, I'm not familiar with the deeper meaning behind some of that, but I could see some of the use cases. And I'm not sure if you've come across a technique in mathematics called topological data analysis, which is sort of a top-down way of trying to look at data and create these different cohorts that are able to then translate that into spatial relational context. And there's been a lot of use within the medical context where you're able to do higher level features by adding in the overall structure of how the data are related to each other in the XYZ, but also to change the colors. So you're able to add sort of heat map plots, but to then from that be able to discover cohorts of information that may be correlated to other things relative to each other. So be able to take higher dimensional analysis and then use something like topological data analysis to be able to really drill down. I saw a talk by Gunnar Carlson at the Joint Mathematics meeting in 2018, and I asked him, hey, I've been using VR, and it was still in the frontier where even the mathematicians weren't necessarily using that, but I'm not sure if you've come across something like that, of those mathematical techniques to start to create those cohorts from something like topological data analysis.
It's definitely something I've heard about. I'm not going to pretend that I understand it. I am not good at math. It was like my most terrible subject at school, which is actually really funny because my father's like a math whiz and PhD. He went to Caltech, all that. It's just not my strength. However, the concept behind that, I can grasp the concept, and the concept absolutely true. And I think there's a lot of examples of that where you're talking about adding the concept of like physical space to something that maybe doesn't have a physical space, but using that physical space or that placement to indicate relationships and add another dimension to things. Like, and maybe I'm not grasping the concept, but that's what I'm assuming that it basically means. And that's absolutely true. And that goes back to the idea of memory palaces, where, you know, you're taking information and using place as another dimension to help recall with it or to add some level of storage or meaning behind it. And I think that's been around for a long, long time. I think, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it goes back to like ancient Greece, the concept of building a three-dimensional model in your head and using placement to indicate some feature of that information. And I think, you know, that's also where the data stadium comes from as well, is like every one of those objects that's within the stadium is placed there for a specific reason and has a specific meaning because it is where it is. And then obviously colors applied to it, height can be applied to the individual points as well. And all of these things have meaning and they all indicate relationships. And it's just a way to show that multidimensionality between these data points and these groups of data points without getting into it in a super complex, because once you start doing these branching nodes and relationships between nodes, it can get very, from a visual perspective or from a usability perspective, get really hairy for people, and especially because it gets very dense if you're showing each individual thing. So, you know, that's one of the reasons why we chose that. Going back to a data stadium or a memory palace, sort of modeling the data stadium off of the concept of a memory palace, and also off the sort of most real world analogous experience that you have. So for me, I went to the World Cup in believe it's 2017, and I went to a stadium in Moscow. They had 78,000 people there. And I thought, well, what would be the, any other way to organize people, that many people, around a specific event or item that would have this sort of structure and meaning? And I couldn't really think of any other experience where you're having that many people in an organized structure. And I thought, well, if I'm going to have that many data points, it makes sense to also organize it in a similarly analogous way, because that works in this multidimensional world. It should also work in VR, and it has worked very well. But yeah, definitely, I can't really speak to like the details of mathematical theory or anything like that, but the concept of using space to indicate relationships is one of, in my opinion, one of the strongest value adds of adding immersive technology to looking at both data visualizations and then also just complex relationships between different groups or different data points.
Yeah, and I think if you can see, as a human, start to see some of the patterns, then something could then be labeled and trained by AI, so it can also be ways to use into the overall pipeline of being able to train machine learning or other types of techniques. But another technique that comes to mind is the network graph analysis of being able to actually do those cohorts that come together, and I'm not sure if that's something that, like, if there's anything that you've done, any sort of the graph analysis that also is able to show pattern relationships and like having things at different size, if that's something that you found, to be able to get a sense of like what is the network of the ecology of this system and to be able to understand the different dynamics of the players, but also how those things unfold over time. I guess that was the other point that I was going to make, which is that there's an element of being able to express your agency and to control and see how the system dynamics are unfolding by having input from the user, and then being able to show that in some way that allows them to understand maybe a larger aspect of the system dynamics, but allows them to kind of play with it like a toy, but then allows them to get a larger grasp of those larger relational dynamics.
Yeah, we've actually worked on supply chain visualization, which I think is a really great example of what you're talking about. And weirdly enough, something that's always really fascinated me is that, like, the scale of large scale supply chains and how different parts of these pieces of one little minor thing can create these cataclysmic events that cause major, major disruptions. And it's not a major issue, it's minor thing causing major disruptions. And how do you see that? Especially because a lot of it has to do with time, a lot of it has to do with flow of data through different pipelines or flow of items through different supply chain pipelines. So anyways, we did a visualization with that. And one of the important parts of bad VR in general is the ability to interact with all of these experiences. So we're not just trying to provide a static 3D model of what you're looking at, because, you know, obviously time and the ability to move through different attributes of data is important to be able to find these relationships, to be able to find, you know, insights, groups and clusters. It's not readily apparent if you're not able to easily manipulate things and easily move through different parts of the data or filter through parts or move through time. Time being a very big one. And being able to show time without interactivity is incredibly difficult, especially to make any sort of meaning out of it without having the ability to actually move time forward or backwards. But with the supply chain visualization, we found it was really hard. As I was speaking to earlier, when you're having, you know, sort of nodes and then relationships between them, especially at volume, becomes very unwieldy for the user, because, you know, your natural inclination is to show it with a line, a node, and then a line between these nodes. And if you're talking about millions and millions of data points, which is most likely in really large scale data sets that exist today, it just becomes all just one, you know, color, you know, so to speak. And that's where that sort of interactivity and the ability to filter became really important, because if you show everything at one time, it just becomes one big line or one big color or one big, you know, sort of mess of colors. So it was really important to be able to start the user off by saying, okay, well, input whatever you'd like to see and then see that and then move through it and filter through it at your own pace. So intake the information that you can while you're in the experience. And here, by the way, is a tool for you to do that. So what we did actually is, I have a big interest in music, as I said, sort of my background. I actually took a DJ mixer that was something that you would link up with Bluetooth. And it was like a MIDI controller, basically, and it has different things that are meant to filter different audio channels. But I map those audio channels to different attributes of the data so that you could use the channel up and down to either bring in the data point or remove the data point or to filter it based upon that point. So that would allow you to sort of move through time with one of these filters, move through location, move through volume, move through manufacturer or supplier or origination point or destination point. And that would allow the user to be able to use a visualization like that. If it was static, it wouldn't work. But that interactivity and that ability to move through time really is critical for the understanding of the user and also for the discovery of insights. Because you're looking at it in a three-dimensional format, it's not obvious from the get-go about what it is that you're looking for, because this is the first time you've seen it this way. A lot of the times, the natural inclination is just to start playing with it, and that's when those really unique insights that you hadn't known even to look for, because you could never see them in 2D, really start to come out and really starts to like show its value. So,
yeah, you mentioned you have a background in music. What's your connection to music?
Well, just that I did an events production company. It was called Black Brothel Productions in Kansas City. So we put on punk shows, and we put on, like, we did a vampirate ball where we had a Voltaire and a couple, like, local bands in Kansas City. So, you know, I was just a really big fan of music. I played technically in a punk band, but we really didn't go anywhere. We were called Cavity Sam. We were like a Bikini Kill Riot Girl band. And we were named after that Operation game, the guy that you take the organs out of. His technical name is Cavity Sam. So we were like trying to dismantle the patriarchy by naming ourselves after this character whose body parts you literally remove. But we didn't go anywhere. And that was between the ages of, like, I don't know, 14 and 16. So mainly more from like the events production side and just being a big fan and managing fan clubs and just building websites for local musicians. Supporting the scene, you know, basically.
Yeah, I asked just because I have an interest in the larger problem of trying to visualize music. And in my talk to the architecture students, one of the things I was talking about was, as a provocation, how visualizing music is actually looking at things, not only how it unfolds in the rhythm of the music, but also the melody and the frequencies of the chords. And so there's many slices of the time. They can do a fast Fourier transform. You can do a, you know, circle of the fifths. You can look at the octaves. You can look at the individual notes. And so there's many different slices you can get when you look at a piece of music through MIDI. But that the thing I was really interested in is the circle of fifths, which puts you into a circle and then creating like ambisonic mixes of a song like Beethoven's Fifth, which I made through Reaper, to be able to actually listen and hear if you could start to perceive through the ambisonic audio and the general concept of sonification, which is something that I've come across quite a bit when doing protein folding and different aspects in molecular sciences, of how the IEEE VR academic conferences, they have a whole workshops on sonification. So ways in which that you could use sound to be able to augment and amplify different aspects of a data visualization. But for music, it makes sense because you are listening to the chords and the chord progression. And so what kind of insights do you get from the geometry of music when you start to do like ambisonic mixes? But I feel like there's a lot of unsolved problems when it comes to, you know, Beat Saber being one of the biggest selling VR experiences of all time is in some sense a music visualizer that is focused on creating an embodied connection to the rhythm. But there's other dimensions of a song when it comes to the chords and the other melodies and the music that are not necessarily being translated in the same spatial dimension, but takes additional thoughts for how to exactly do that. So as a provocation for data visualization, I think the challenge of visualizing music over time to understand the underlying structure of the music is something that I've taken on a huge interest in, and what kind of things may come out of that level of experimentation that then leads into broader aspects of how to visualize the time domain within these immersive visualizations.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely, I play several instruments. I learned to play the bagpipes. I have a Scottish background, so I weirdly enough play the bagpipes. I played violin when I was in high school, and I played guitar when I was in my Cavity Sam punk band. So I don't know a ton about music theory, but I know enough to read music, and specifically bagpipe music, you have all these like weird grace notes and things that like, and you're playing on weird like time signatures that you would not normally play on if you're talking about, you know, mainstream rhythmic music. So I can't really speak to the technical aspects of that, but I do obviously think there's a huge realm when you're talking about visualizing sound. Number one, just visualizing sound in music and the different relationships between the attributes of the song, but then also using sound as an input in immersive experiences that relate to data, and using sound as one point of communicating some attribute about a data set or a data point. I think that's really powerful, and overall just in immersive experiences, you know, immersive sound is really underutilized as both in the user experience, a director, you know, when you're going through experiences, and then also as a information input device. And that's something that we've been wanting to add into our C-signal experience when you're talking about RF frequencies, because really you can talk about RF frequencies, but you can also tie them to an actual sound frequency. And if you're converting RF frequencies into sound frequencies, that could be a very interesting other way to add another layer to the visualization or to the experience, because really it's not even just visualization anymore. It's the embodiment of that data and how you get that data into the user's body. So instead of just using colors or using shapes, you can use other inputs like sound and movement around a space and having the sound change that can communicate things to the user about, in that case, RF frequencies, but in other cases, other attributes of the data set. But another thing that we've talked about too that I think would be really interesting would be something like C-signal, but for sound. So I can talk about it more from the event production side, like how do I run sound on a particular room? Like different rooms have different ways that you would set up, you know, talking about speakers, or you're talking about doing the mixing board, or how you would mix different, you know, if you're having a guitar, different channels of audio that's coming through. But the problem for me, I would love to do this from a passion perspective, but from a business side, I don't know that there's enough money in that industry or enough people really wanting to use this product. But yeah, if you could put money aside or put use case aside and just give me something to look at, it would be that. Absolutely, like visualizing the way that sound moves through a room and how you can change that based upon where you place something or the different type of speakers that you're using or the different way something is mixed. I would love to see that. Would be so cool to me. And then the other thing, not related to sound, but just as a side note, I'm a big fan about like ghost hunting and stuff. So I want to take EMF data and see that spatially, because you know, like you go on ghost hunting tours, they give you an EMF reader, you walk around and it goes off and it's like, oh, ghost is right here. Who knows if that's true or not? However, what if instead of having to walk around a space with my little EMF reader, get a reading here, I'm just putting on a headset and see there's a spike here, there's a spike there, I can know exactly where all the ghosts are.
Yeah, well, I wanted to talk about the C-signal as an experience, because just to kind of explain it a little bit for as we've been talking about it. So the C-signal, my experience was I put on the HoloLens 2 and was able to walk around some of the expo floor, and it's almost like each of these devices are able to detect a whole range of different RF signals from different Wi-Fi. And usually when you log on to a Wi-Fi, you don't really think about a room being flooded with all these other signals, but they're all there. So being able to walk around and seeing like almost this quantized space, these little columns that are telling you as you logged on to a specific Wi-Fi network, how strong the signal is as you're walking around. So it seems like presumably some sort of way to maybe debug some of the different aspects of, like, if you're getting an area where the Wi-Fi is really weak and other areas where it's really strong, then are there ways to locate those places, but also to then do other things to fix it in some fashion? So maybe you could talk about the background for the C-signal and how it came about and how you see this as a conceit being used.
Yeah, it's actually funny. Like, C-signal is one of those really simple ideas that when you look at it, you're like, well, obviously. But it came about in, like, very interesting format. It wasn't super obvious. So I believe the last time we spoke, it was at LeapCon, Magic LeapCon. So when I attended LeapCon, I met up with a bunch of people, Steve Lucas being one of them, and a bunch of developer relations people from Magic Leap. They ended up inviting me and my team. And this is back before we were funded. This is like, Bad VR was like literally two people at that point. It was like me and my co-founder. We didn't have anyone else, but they invited us to this hackathon that was sponsored by AT&T up in San Francisco. And, you know, obviously you're building something for Magic Leap, and then you have to, like, you know, it's a hackathon. So they give you just these various, very vague inputs, and then you come up with some idea. So for me, I thought, well, if it's sponsored by AT&T, we do immersive data visualization, it only makes sense to look at telephone signals within a room. Also, at the same time, I was living in a loft in downtown LA that was made of concrete. So every time I would try to use my phone anywhere inside my home, because I had a big balcony, so if I walked back from the balcony, didn't have any cell signal. But weirdly enough, I would fall asleep and my bed was like on the way back wall. I'd wake up with like 5 missed calls. I'm like, how did the calls get through right there, but I can't make a call here? So I had this, it was just sort of like born out of both the frustration of never being able to make calls in my house, or to be able to always receive them but never make them, unless I was standing out in the balcony, it was really loud, and so it didn't ever make sense. And I had to like actually get a landline. It was so annoying, because also the Wi-Fi didn't work. in addition to the like, oh, it's branded AT&T with Magic Leap. So like the obvious thing in my mind was like, well, use AT&T data stuff because I had an AT&T phone. Like, put that. Let's just see that in the room. Seemed simple enough. It wasn't simple. Found out very quickly, but we did our best, you know, and didn't win the hackathon, but the idea came out of that hackathon. And at the time, we actually asked Brian Wong, who is a developer in the Magic Leap community, who ended up coming to work for me. He's now our VP of engineering. We met him at that event, and he was on our hackathon team. So in more ways than one, it was a really transformative event for the company. And then that C-Signal idea got so much traction on Twitter and social media. Roni, the CEO of Magic Leap, talked about it a lot. And I feel like that fed into us receiving a grant from Magic Leap through their independent creators program for quite a bit of money that sort of kickstarted the company, helped us raise money, helped us then get more grants. And really, that event was sort of a pivotal time for the business and really showing not only that we could do stuff like cool stuff, but that also, hey, there are some really cool use cases for immersive data visualization that are not just 3D charts and graphs on somebody's like tabletop. So, yeah, but that's where the whole idea came from, honestly.
Yeah, and I was just at the AR-VR Policy Summit that was put on by the ITIF and XR Association, and there was some representative there from the National Science Foundation talking about a number of different immersive projects that had received grants and funding, and mentioned BadVR as being a recipient as one of those grants. Maybe you could give a bit more context as to what the National Science Foundation was funding and what that project was all about.
Yeah. So it sort of ties into C-Signal. It wasn't C-Signal specifically, but we had actually heard about the NSF Seed Fund. We had a friend, actually it was a friend of Jazz who had a friend that had received a CBER Phase 1 from the NSF at the very beginning of their sort of Seed Fund thing. So we talked to this individual, and actually my cousin ended up getting one too, and I didn't realize it, but I also spoke to him about that once I realized that that had happened and sort of learned about that process. And I thought, you know, I'm just going to broadly submit the idea for immersive data visualization to them and see if they fund it. They didn't initially. They kicked it back, the CBER Phase 1, and said, you know what, you have to be a little bit more specific about this. Resubmit with these changes. And so what we ended up submitting was geospatial data visualization using virtual reality technology. So that was the CBER Phase 1 for the National Science Foundation. They founded that. We completed that. And then in our CBER Phase 2, which is basically an extension of that research that we did in the Phase 1, we pitched, you know, look, we did the research. We really have the strong use case for telecom. So instead of looking at just broadly speaking geospatial data using VR, we think it would be amazing to look at RF signal data overlaid basically with a geospatial environment, looking at it at a city level, looking at it on a room level, using AR technology instead of VR technology. So just changing it a little bit, honing it a little bit based upon our user research, based upon market research. And that's what we basically submitted for our CBER Phase 2 to the NSF. That got funded, and that's where we are now. So it's not specifically C-Signal in that it's not just limited to the room. You're also able to go back in the experience and look at it on a city level, look at it on a nationwide level, stuff like that as well. So broadly speaking, RF signal data in a geospatial multidimensional setting.
Great. Yeah, well, there's been a lot that's happened since the last time I saw you. You've got a lot more employees, you've got these grants. And so who are the main customers that you're finding that are finding resonance with this whole field of immersive visualization? And just a little side note too, being here, we have everything from the Quest, you have the Tilt 5 AR demos doing data visualization, you have the HoloLens, so you're using all these different devices. So who out in the field are your customers, and where are you finding traction with these concepts of immersive visualization?
Yeah, so we, from early on, really, I mean, we've always loved Magic Leap because they gave us our first grant, but we've always tried to build really agnostic, so it works on any sort of device, including like AR-enabled smartphones and tablets and stuff like that, because we've really found that, you know, people believe in the concept of immersive data visualization, but sometimes it really comes down to like being a little weird about the headset or not really wanting to have a learning curve on that. So we've really just tried to make it as broadly usable as possible on different types of headsets. But I'm speaking to the different industries. We've seen a lot of traction in telecom, specifically for C-Signal. Outside of that, a lot of smart cities, a lot of utility companies looking at grids of IoT sensors, looking at real-time data sets, a lot of like meteorological use cases, a lot of aviation use cases when we're talking about the weather, looking at multidimensional weather patterns, and then obviously first responders. So that's something that we've also been publicly working with a lot, specifically like fire departments working with the huge wildfire problem in California. How do you best utilize resources with that? How do you visualize data sets around that to really help both respond to it with the lowest loss of life, and then also how to prevent it moving forward in the future? Because it is definitely a spatial data set, a spatial problem, and it is something that is very, very large scale that's really hard to sort of communicate on one single screen or even multiple different flat screens. So I would say those are the main areas. There's a lot of, I've actually been quite surprised at how really forward thinking a lot of municipal governments are when you're talking about smart cities, when you're talking about sometimes utilities, and then of course, you know, public safety, first responders, EMS, all of those departments, all of those industries, all of those sectors right now have this very huge focus towards wanting to find better ways to do what they're doing using data. Because a lot of them have all of this data, but they don't really have a good way to utilize it. So they have their sort of standard practices, things that they've always been doing, workflows that they've always been doing. But then they had, you know, a couple of years ago, this big push to gather all this data and to have all these data sets. But like, how do you take all that data and then apply it to the workflows that they've been doing, all the things that they've done in the past, and how do you best change those workflows using this data to make them more optimized, all of that. So it's that process of applying the data to the day-to-day experiences, to the established best practices, to either change them, tweak them, make them better. And I didn't expect those particular industries, but that's really where we've seen a lot of traction from. So,
yeah, one of the first commercial ventures that I talked to back at like Silicon Valley Virtual Reality 2015 with data visualization was Quant VR, which at the time they were trying to do data visualization of financial information, financial data. So think about like stock market analysts, people who are trading, they have like these monitors, like 10 monitors up with all this data charts. They're just trying to track all this information. And so is that something that Bad VR has looked at all? It's trying to translate all these different 2D charts and put it into more of a spatial context that may be allowing stock market analysts to be able to get more embodied interactions or interactive interactions with a huge amounts of data with what's happening in real time on the financial context.
Yeah, definitely. It's very interesting because a lot of people bring that up because it seems to be a very obvious use case. And I agree. It's like, well, obviously, one of the biggest utilizers of data are stock traders, the financial markets and all of that. The problem that seems to happen is because that data tends to not really be geospatial inherently, you run into that issue we spoke about earlier where it's like, well, how do I look at this? And if I'm looking at it in charts and graphs and I'm just adding another dimension to these charts and graphs or even adding a couple dimensions to it, does it really add additional value to what it is that they're looking for or the workflows that they're performing? And the answer, at least for us right now and what we've done, is not really. So while they're always initially really interested, we run into an issue with the product. Like, we just don't know what the right product is for that right now or the right way to display that data. And to also be quite honest, none of us have a financial services industry or background or know a lot about it. So it hasn't really been something that, you know, I think to really find the right interface for that data, I would need to hire someone with like deep industry knowledge because I just don't understand enough about their workflows to come up with a better or best practice for ways to display those data sets. So while I believe there's a huge opportunity there, it's just not something that, you know, is best suited for our team or this industry right now, or my business right now, I should say. Yeah.
Yeah, I've talked to Jason Marsh and other folks at Flow Immersive, and they've been doing some work with BlackRock Creative, and there's ways in which that you can, not necessarily in the context of a day trader who's looking at an individual stock and all the data, but more of like these large level trends that you may be able to look at lots of data from just trying to get a sense of where an industry is at and where it's going, how it's growing, and more at the higher level of making judgments around the patterns that are emerging across this big amounts of data rather than making an individual decision in the context of whether or not you should buy or sell a single stock. So that's the stuff that I've seen is more of a higher level trend seeking and patterns rather than looking at a more micro scale.
Yeah, I could definitely see that being true. And I could also see it being tied to some sort of geographic, like energy prices in a geographic region or commodities prices in a geographic region and looking for that on a global trend scale. Like, definitely agree with you. It's a high level seeking trends and relationships between trends and global patterns that I could see that being a big value add. But I do think that when you're talking about people from the financial services, when they come to us seeking a product, they want something a little bit more than that because they feel that they're able to do that pretty well now. So I just don't really quite understand understand what the product is that they're looking for. But I personally think there's value in it. And I think there are people that do see that, but it just never seems that we have the right vision for what the people that come to us looking for that. So I don't really know quite yet. I'm still working on it. So, yeah.
Are there any ways that bad VR eats your own dog food by doing data visualization for how you're running your VR company? Or are there other ways that you've started to visualize aspects of either your own life or your own company within bad VR?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I use C-Signal in my own house now. I have like the most amazing coverage. I don't have dropped call problems anymore. I don't have Wi-Fi issues anymore. So definitely eat my own dog food on that. But beyond that, we use immersive technology to do a lot of our product design and a lot of the UX design for our products. So as a team, we often get into, you remember an app, magically called Spatiate, where you all go into one environment. It's like Paint, but with multiple people and within a multidimensional space. Or what, I can't remember the name of the one that was on a VR painting app. Everybody knows that. I can't.
Tilt Brush,
thank you. Yes, it basically Tilt Brush, but for AR and multi-user at the same time. We use that all the time. We have different products that we use now that we've actually built internally that sort of build on that concept of Spatiate, but have our own design library where we're able to bring things in and do voice sharing and chatting and communication and then painting, you know, or we don't call it painting, it's annotation or whatever. But so I would say that we eat our own dog food in the sense that I individually use my product, but then also when we're doing design, we design immersively. We don't try to design on a 2D screen, multidimensional objects. When we're doing that product design, we start in an immersive space, and then maybe we'll take that to do 2D mock-ups if we need to, or 2D, 3D mock-ups if needed to communicate the concept. But all of it just starts from a spatial vision, and I think that you can feel that when you're in our product. It didn't start on a 2D screen. So I think that's really eating our own dog food as well. So,
what are some of the either problems that you're working on or new features that you're working on in terms of, like, with all the different customers and problems, where's the overlap in terms of the things that seem to be coming up in the realm of immersive visualization?
Yeah, a lot of it comes down to wanting to bring in models or predictive algorithms and not only look at the data that's here today or the data that was here yesterday, but how do we take that data and then use it to make an immersive model of what might happen tomorrow? So that's really the next step in our product and the thing that I'm most focused on, the thing that my co-founder's most focused on, is really finding ways to come in, bring that predictive element to the immersive experiences that we have, because I think we're very strong in visualizing live data feeds, visualizing data right now, visualizing data from the past, but we really need to work on using all of that data to inform better predictive models, or for instance, like with C-Signal, doing predictions of, hey, if I change the location of a router or I change the location of a microcell, how would that then change the propagation throughout a room? It goes back to also the audio. If I move a speaker from here to there, how does that change the audio sound or the way that sound propagates through a room? So looking at those things without having to actually move the router or move the speaker, using predictive algorithms and models to say, okay, you can digitally move it and this is what it would be like. So I think that's really the next step in immersive data visualization, in addition to tackling that problem of how do you display non-geospatial data in a really user-friendly format. Yeah,
the thing I'm also looking forward to is the multimodal integrations with sonification and sound, but also the haptic integration. I think there's a lot of potential for what could happen with being able to use something like a neosensory vest or something that is maybe spread out across your body and being able to translate the spatial information into a haptic experience, you know, especially as you're moving your body through the space and you're able to feel it. So I think there's a lot of probably untapped potentials for, especially when you really dig into the concepts of embodied cognition, how our mind is in the context of our brain, but also in the context of our body, but also in the context of the environment. So this ideas of distributed cognition, where ways that we process information is contextually relevant. So what are the ways that if you change the contextual information, that gives you a deeper understanding, but as you move your body through that space, and then you have that method of loci, which is, you know, goes back to the Greeks, but that memory palace element, but having both sonification and maybe eventually smells or taste, but, you know, that's probably more speculative. But if you really look at starting with the visuals, then the sonification, the sounds, and then moving into the more haptic realms, I'm excited to see where that type of experimentation is going to come from when it comes to the multimodal fusion of all those things.
Absolutely, me too. And I look forward to people using extra senses in all sort of user interfaces. Specifically with data, it can be very, very interesting to communicate different data points or attributes of data points, as I mentioned, but then also just broadly across the spectrum of immersive experiences, using more than just visuals or using more than just, you know, some brief little arrows here or there, really, really, truly utilizing sound as a part of the experience, an integral part of the experience, and then also haptics, absolutely. I think that would be so rad. I haven't really seen like very user-friendly haptics yet. I would really love to see that. But I think those are really some attributes of user interface design for immersive designers that are very underutilized and that can be really, really valuable and that have really exciting frontiers for communicating data sets, especially in my opinion, when you start talking about, you know, things that have an analogous to sound, like RF signals, which are also signals, and sound is a signal, and they sort of have this like interesting correlation, so the experience could really tie together in a very artistic and very creative way. So yeah, I'm really excited for that stuff too. Spatial audio, in my opinion, is just completely rad. I love the idea, and I really hope that more experiences utilize that fully and use it as an instructor, use it as a point of not just music, but like to actually navigate someone through the experience and to communicate some attribute or some data point or some instruction to the user. Yeah.
Great. And finally, what do you think the ultimate potential of immersive technologies and immersive visualization might be, and what it might be able to enable?
Oh, that's crazy. Go back and reference back to the holodeck. You know, growing up, I was a big Star Trek fan, The Next Generation mainly. But like, I think that you have this ability to very much be able to step into a future where data is something that you can either go into and create a whole new world with, where you're looking for trends and patterns fully immersed in that data. Or you can use the other attribute of it where you're overlaying it over your real world. So you're augmenting your real world experience. And I think, you know, when people think of immersive data visualization, they really think AR and VR sort of analogous, like, oh, well, it's a VR experience, but it could also be AR. But in my opinion, those two things go in very, very different directions when you're talking long term about the future. You have one experience where you are trying to get as much data as possible, most likely non-geospatial data, data that's very abstract. You're going completely into some other world, immersing yourself in that. And I think we're going to have these like chairs and, you know, possibly it's even a room or completely immersed in a VR headset where you're not really in this real world anymore. And the world around you is just all fed by data and created by data. Or, like I said, you have these experiences that really are meant to just augment your real world and help you live a better life by utilizing data to inform different behaviors and decisions as you're moving through the real world. And I think that both of those futures are really exciting, and I think there's value in use cases for both of them. I think, you know, C-Signal would be an example of that one where it's like, oh, you're just augmenting your ability to move through a room or to understand some attribute of your real world by being able to see things that you previously would not be able to see or to know information about your real world environment that you didn't previously know. But, you know, the use cases for VR where you're talking about just real worlds that are made out of data, I think that's more of the like possibly the stockbroker or the financial services where you're looking at really abstract data sets and trying to find these trends and patterns. But yeah, so I think it sort of diverts in these two directions. But I think if we talk 10 years from now, it'll be one of those two things or both of those things, but they're not, they don't sort of cross each other. They're very distinct from each other. Yeah. That
makes sense. Great. And is there anything else that's left unsaid that you'd like to say to the broader immersive community?
I've just been very thankful to the immersive community, broadly speaking, and specifically to the Magic Leap community for being so supportive of me as a female entrepreneur, so supportive of my vision, my wacky vision for immersive data visualization, especially given that I don't have like a mathematics background, I don't have like a data science background. Like all that I was is a product designer, a UX designer that worked with data sets that just tried to make them easy to understand for non-technical people because I felt passionate about giving them the ability to understand that data. So I just think it's beautiful that the community has embraced my vision, has embraced my company, and being here at AWE, I've had so many people stop by and congratulate me and support me or, you know, given me a hand in ways that I could have never hoped that anybody ever would, sort of paying that forward. And I hope in the future I have the opportunity to give that kindness back. So
just a question on the name of Bad VR. How did you come up with that? Because it seems so in some ways counterintuitive that you'd want to sort of associate yourself with something that is associated with something that is so bad. So what does the bad VR mean to you?
Yeah. So bad VR is actually an acronym. It stands for bring all your data to VR. But I also sort of ran with it in the vein of, you know, being so bad that it's good or being badass. You know, I come from that sort of like alternative background, and I just wanted something that was shocking and different and not what people would think that it would be. And I sort of wanted to challenge people to be like, well, whatever it is, they don't know, or they're not going to be able to guess what it is. So number one, it's going to draw them in. But number two, it's going to challenge their preconceived notions of like, oh, well, if it's an immersive data company, it has to be run by PhDs and it has to be immersed data something, you know, in the name. It has to be super professional and enterprisey. I just wanted to like just say no to all that and do something completely different and challenge people to accept it based on the talents of everyone who was involved. And I think that we've proven ourselves to some extent. And, you know, I still do get the odd comment here or there about like, oh, I hate the name. But for every hating the name comment, we get five more that are like, that's awesome. So I'm sticking with it.
I can see that punk background coming through there.
I can't help it. Once a punk, always a punk.
Awesome. Well, Suzanne, thank you so much for taking the time to chat today during the conference. And, you know, as I go around and see a lot of demos, what was really striking to me about the bad VR demos was just the breadth of lots of different devices, but also just the immersive, you know, visualizations. It's just really cool to see the different types of projects that you've been working on. And yeah, just nice to be able to kind of sit down and unpack it again here. And hopefully get both of these podcasts out. I wanted to sort of have this historical evolution because it is quite an interesting story as you've been on this journey. So thanks for taking another opportunity to capture this moment of your journey.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you having me. Appreciate it.
Thanks again for listening to this episode of the Voices of VR podcast. And if you enjoy the podcast, then please do spread the word, tell your friends, and consider becoming a member of the Patreon. This is a supportive podcast. And so I do rely upon donations from people like yourself in order to continue to bring this coverage. So you can become a member and donate today at patreon.com/voices of VR. Thanks for listening.